Good evening, and welcome to the Church of the Redeemer. As far as I know, David Brooks didn't go to medical school, but he's one of the best social diagnosticians that I've ever encountered. What brought us here today, he asks in one way or another, several times a week in print and on the air. What's broken? Who's hurting? How is some system sick, and who's responsible for it? And what can we do to get things patched up? Some mornings, as you know, he has a bitter pill for us to swallow. Some days there's a little sugar. But he always intends our body politic to be a bit more well for his asking. The story of the Fisher King is a part of the legend of Arthur. And it begins when the good king has been mortally wounded. Though his heart still pumps blood, he cannot stand and rarely leaves his chamber. And if he is to fish, he must be carried by a small boat by attendants. In this state, the kingdom lay fallow, and everyone's soul was peckish. Most people went about their daily tasks lethargically, as if in a trance and feeling sick themselves. At this moment, a fatherless young man named Parsifal comes of age, and he encounters the king's knights riding along one day on the road. Awestruck by their shining appearance, he sets off for the castle. Parsifal is struck dumb by what he finds there. Instead of the glorious Camelot that he expected, he finds himself in the middle of a wasteland where everything is sterile and cold. He discovers that the king has been wounded in the middle of his body, and he's lost the powers of potency and regeneration. The young knight wants desperately to help his people and the king, but like everyone else, he had no answers about how to heal the wound. Instead, his mind is filled with questions. Yet he dammed them up, but remembering that his mother had told him not to embarrass people by probing too much. Some of you have mothers that way. So he leaves the court on a quest. After venturing down many blind paths and false trails, Parsifal glimpses the Holy Grail, the cup purportedly used at the Last Supper. And as a result of this glimpse, and here's the miracle, Parsifal experiences the king's pain as his own. He feels something deep and hurtful and broken within his own heart. So he rides back to the castle and rushes to the king, who is at this point at death's door. Overcoming his earlier hesitance, he kneels beside the monarch and asks him, "What ails thee? Where does it hurt? How are you suffering? What system is broken? What ails thee?" And the spell is broken. Through Parsifal asking him an honest question of compassion, the king is restored and the inhabitants of the kingdom along with him. And the king offers him a toast. "When you falter and fail, never forget, today holds the promise of redemption." Well, David Brooks, at least tonight, but I think many mornings, is our Parsifal, wondering again and again what truly ails us as individuals and as a society, asking us the hard questions and through them leading us and the communities we create to be more life-giving, more compassionate, and truly just. It's my honor to welcome David Brooks.
Thank you, David. That was, I haven't had an introduction like that ever. So I appreciate it. I'm feeling the presence of being up here. I'm feeling I might be called to, I don't know if you need an associate pastor up here, but I've only given one real sermon on a Sunday morning in my life, and that was at the National Cathedral, so I sort of started at the top. And as I was walking up there, the head minister whispered to me, "You know, Martin Luther King gave his last sermon from this spot." But it's sort of odd for me. I went to a school, a school called Grace Church School in New York at 10th and Broadway, if you know where the Strand Bookstore, it's right next to there. And I was in the choir, and the choir, we were 40% Jewish, because it's New York. and we would sing, but to square it with our religion, we wouldn't sing the word Jesus. And so the volume would drop down, and then we'd come back up and shoot back up. And so moved by this, I was just reading some books on faith actually today, and I don't know if any of you have read, over the course of my life, dozens of people have recommended I read this book, Jaber Crow, by Wendell Berry. And if you haven't read it, it's got a beautiful description of actually somebody coming to faith. It's a guy, he's in his early 20s, and he has failed as a student, and he's failed as a worker, and he decides to walk home. And he's walking through Kentucky, and there's a flood, and it's wiping out all the bridges, and the river is swollen, and it's sweeping homes along, and it's really life-threatening. But he foolishly goes over a bridge, and he says out there on the crest of the bridge, the river was like a living element. It was like a crowd shouting. And above and within the uproar of the water, I could hear the sleet hissing down. I could feel the river throbbing in the bridge. I can't say it was not afraid, but it seemed the fear was not in me, but in the air, like the sound of the river. It seemed to me something I had gone into and could not expect to go out of very soon. And so he's talking about this sense he got in the going over the river, that it was not just the river that was alive, but all of creation that was alive. And he doesn't have any food, he doesn't have a place to stay, and it's really life-threatening to be out there. And he finally trudges into a town hall, and there are volunteers in the hall just feeding people. And he joins this soaked throng, just trudging in, getting food and water, a place to sleep, and then going out. And he remembers the river as he's sitting there sleeping in the town hall. He has a dream where he can see the whole river. And he says, I'm not sure that I can tell you what was happening to me then, or even that I know it now. I wasn't really trying to tell myself anything. But after all my years of reading in that old book and hearing it read and believing and disbelieving it, I seem to have wandered all the way back to the beginning, to the flood, not just of the book, but of the world. And all the rest of it that was yet to come, I felt knowledge crawl over my skin. And I like that sense of knowledge crawling over skin, because sometimes when we learn something deep, it's not through our rational mind. It sort of comes into us bodily. And he wrote, I knew that spirit had gone forth to shape the world and make it living and was still alive in it. I just had no doubt at that moment. I could see that I lived in a created world and it was still being created. I would be part of it forever. There was no escape. The spirit was made into it, shaping it and reshaping it, sometimes lying, sometimes at rest, shaking itself like a muddy horse and letting the pieces fly. And so one of the things I like about that passage is the sense of learning in different ways. Learning with your whole body, through your whole experience, through an emotional and spiritual and physical experience. And this is a tough thing for me to learn, because over the course of my life, I grew up in a super intellectual household, and I grew up starting at age 7 knowing I wanted to be a writer. I read a book called Paddington the Bear, if anybody's read that book. And at that moment, I decided I was going to be a writer, and there probably haven't been 7 days that I haven't written since. I remember in high school, I wanted to date a woman named Bernice, and she didn't want to date me. She wanted to date some other guy. And I remember thinking, what is she thinking? I write way better than that guy. But she wanted other things. And then when I was 18, I was still writing, and I wanted to go to a college where they could teach writing. And the admissions officers at Columbia, Wesleyan and Brown, decided I should go to the University of Chicago. And so left with only one option. And the old-fashioned saying about Chicago is it's where fun goes to die. The more accurate saying is that it's a Baptist school where atheist professors teach Jewish students St. Thomas Aquinas. And they still wear t-shirts. It's a heady place. And again, you can see somebody trapped in their own brain. They wear t-shirts at Chicago. Sure, it works in practice, but does it work in theory? And so I went there, and I was wanting to be intellectual, and I double majored in history and celibacy while I was there. And I teach at Yale now. I only teach schools I couldn't have gotten into. And some of those kids that I teach now have skills I didn't have. Like, you ask them, they have these super voluntary skills. They're community-oriented. You ask them, what are you doing at spring break? It's like, I don't know, I'm going to unicycle across Thailand while reading to lepers. So they do all that. They do have the skill which I did have, which is the ability to dominate classroom discussion while doing none of the reading. And so that was a bookish place, and it made me a bookish person. And so books and ideas and talking became my career. I'm now a conservative columnist at the New York Times, which is a job I liken to being the chief rabbi at Mecca. Not a lot of company there all the time. And then I do the show on the NewsHour with Mark Shields. Our segment, thank you. Our segment is called Shields and Brooks. It should have been Brooks Shields. That would have been better. And I always joke that Mark has been doing this for a few years. Right now, the segment is called Shields and Brooks. Before it was Shields and Chigo, and then before that it was Shields and Gergen, and then it was Shields and Coolidge, I think, and then I think Shields and Thomas A. Becket. I don't know. It goes back. It's still, again, by TV standards, it's sort of intellectual. We have, I think, a thoughtful audience. It's an older audience. We serve a certain demographic. So if a 93-year-old lady comes up to me in the airport, I know what she's going to say. I don't watch your show, but my mother loves it. And so we're just big in the hospice community. And so it's, again, intellectual and really a life based on writing books and writing columns. Though I think as you get older, especially as a guy, you get a little more feminine, maybe a little more in touch with your feminine side. I'm the only American male who finished that book, Eat, Pray, Love, if you remember that book. By page 123, I was lactating, which was kind of odd. And then a few years ago, I wrote a book about emotion called The Social Animal. My friends all joke that me writing a book about emotion is like Gandhi writing about gluttony. It's not like not the natural thing. And then I wrote a book 3 years ago called The Road to Character. I learned writing that book that writing a book on character doesn't give you good character. And even reading a book on character doesn't give you good character. But buying a book on character does give you good character. So I recommend that. And so all of this is to say intellect is a lot of what we emphasize in our society and a lot of what we educate kids for. But I think despite that, I think one of the things you learn as you go through life is that that's actually not the most important part of who we are and not the most important part of our consciousness. And that when Descartes tried to separate intellect and raise it as the highest of human elements, he got it wrong. And the first and most important part of our consciousness, and I have to say this, and I would say it anyway, but my wife is in the room, so I emphasize it, is the desiring heart, the desire for love, and the desire for intimacy and connection. I recently read about a guy who bought a home with a bamboo stand near the driveway, and he chopped down the bamboo because he wanted to get rid of it, and he took an axe and chopped into the root system. Then he poured plant poison over what was left. Then he put 3 feet of gravel and then 3 or 4 inches of concrete on top. And you know what happened. 2 years later, little shoot of bamboo sticking through the concrete. And I think it's true that we have something like that in ourselves, which is our desiring heart. We're what a writer named Jamie Smith called, we're existential sharks. We have to be on the move. We're always desiring. And what we desire is intimacy and connection and relation with one another. A few years ago, there was a orphanage many years ago in Nevada where they decided they would give the kids, little babies, health care and food, but they didn't want to touch them because they didn't want to give them germs. And 38% of the kids died before age 2 because it's actually the fibers of the brain that get wired together by affection and connection and by emotion. And so we are wired together by our love, and what we love most of all and what we want most of all is to fuse with other people and to have the kind of connection that a writer named Louis de Bernier wrote in a book called Captain Corelli's Mandolin. In that book, there's an old guy, and he's talking to his daughter about his relationship with his late wife, and he says, "Love itself is what is left over when being in love is burned away. And this is both an art and a fortunate accident. Your mother and I had it. We had roots that grew towards each other underground, And when all the pretty blossoms had fallen from our branches, we discovered that we were one tree and not two. And that's what we're looking for. And so that is the desiring of the heart. The second thing, that's the second most important of our consciousness, is our yearning soul. Now, despite where I'm standing right here, I'm not in the business of telling people whether to believe in God or not believe in God. That's David's job, not mine. But I would try to persuade you of whether you're whatever you believe in or don't believe in, that there is some piece of you that has no shape or size or weight or color, but is of infinite value and dignity. And that rich and successful people don't have more of this than poor or less successful people, and older people don't have more of it than younger people. And it is a thing that gives each individual infinite dignity. And slavery is wrong because it's an obliteration of another human being's soul. And that rape is not just an attack on a bunch of physical molecules, it's an obliteration of another human soul. And obscenity has been defined as anything that covers over another person's soul. And what this thing does is it yearns. It yearns for goodness. I've never met anybody covering wars and crime. I've never met anybody who didn't want to be good. And when you meet people, even people who committed genocide, they always explain to you why what they did was excusable or maybe good. You just don't see it. We all want to lead good lives, and we all fall apart if we don't. And so I've come to notice this in a lot of the people I interview, especially people maybe over 50 or over 60, that their lives take on a two-mountain shape. They get out of college or whatever, and they start climbing their mountain, which is their career. And they build a family, and they buy a home, and they think, this is the mountain I'm going to climb in my life. And then some years later, sometimes soon, sometimes later, they get to the top of the mountain, and they think, you know, this isn't as quite as satisfying as I thought it would be. Or else something bad happens, they get fired from their job, their career derails, they lose a child, and they go down in the valley. And the paradox of the valley is you can see life more clearly from the bottom than you can from the top. And what the valley does especially is it, as Paul Tillich said, this 1950s theologian, it reminds you you're not who you thought you were. It opens up a hole in what you thought was the basement of your soul, and it carves through the floor of that basement and reveals a cavity below, and it carves through that and reveals a cavity below. And when you see those cavities deeper inside yourself than you ever thought you knew about, you realize there's only a certain sort of food that can fill that void, and it's a spiritual food and not anything else. And so people then say, you know, that first mountain, that turned out not to be my mountain. And there's a second mountain ahead. And the second mountain tends to be more about pouring forth, less about building the ego, more about pouring forth and giving back and contributing. Less outward and more inward. And so some people, they just switch careers. I met a guy in North Carolina about a month ago who was a banker. And he did that for 25 years, quit, became a pastor. That wasn't satisfying to him. And so now he works at helping men as they're leaving prison make that transition. And as he talked about that, he had that incandescent glow you see with people on their second mountain. I have a friend who's a very successful entrepreneur and businesswoman, and she employs a lot of people in the Central Valley of California, and she built an amazing company. Every pistachio you've ever eaten was made by Linda. And she sort of lost interest. And now she's trying to minister to the families who pick the nuts in the Central Valley. And so when you go to the preschool there with her, she knows every kid's name, even though her company is a multi-billion dollar company, and it's all she can talk about. And that is because of the yearning soul. And so the heart and the soul are the two most important things about us, and they are the things that bond us with one another. The mind sometimes can separate us, and the emphasis on intellect can sometimes separate us, but the heart and the soul are bonding. And so one of the things they do is they bond us into cultures to help us solve our problems. And one of the paradoxes of the current age is that we have sort of lost touch, I think, with parts of ourselves. We've become divided within ourselves. And when you have a culture that becomes divided within yourself, you're going to wind up with a divided society. And so, as I mentioned, we had Descartes and the French Enlightenment, which separated mind from heart. We had Industrial Revolution that reduced human beings to cogs in a machine. We had a meritocratic revolution that treats human beings as sources of social capital and not as embodiments of soul. And if you go to fancy colleges, you sometimes think of yourself as just an embodiment of human capital that I got to exploit on my way to achievement. And Marx talked about the bosses exploiting the laborers. In a super hyper achievement oriented societies, people are their own bosses and they exploit themselves. And so you get this separation from self, you get a separation from each other. And so the final thing we've done to isolate societies, we've had a culture of individualism. And we've had 40 years of cultures of individualism. So if you go back to the culture, say, between 1932 and 1968, you have a generation that had to face depression and war, and it was very group-oriented. People tended to join big organizations, the army, the labor unions, big companies, and they lived in tight communities. I wasn't in Baltimore then, but I saw a diner. And I know this was a city, and in many ways remains a city, of tight communities. I'm a little more familiar with Chicago. If you grew up on Chicago's South Side in the 1950s, you probably went to work at the Nabisco plant where your dad worked and went to the same union. If you lived in the neighborhoods on the Southwest Side, it was before TV and it was before air conditioning. So in the summertime, the doors were open and the kids ran from home to home. And the communities were tightly knit. There were coffee klatches, babysitting cooperatives, barbecues. They were all just jammed together. And if somebody asked you, where do you live? You didn't say, I live in Chicago. You say, I live at 59th and Pulaski, because it was your neighborhood that mattered. And I think that's still true here. And you joined big organizations and you rose through big organizations. There was a guy named John Ferry who wanted to go into politics. So he didn't just think, oh, I'm gonna raise some money and run for office. He joined the machine. That's what you did, you joined the thing. And so he worked for Boss Daley's machine, and Boss Daley sent him to Springfield for 20 years. And at the end of his career, Boss Daley decided to reward him with a seat in Congress in Washington. And they asked John Ferry, how are you going to vote when you get to Washington? And he told the reporters, I will go to Washington and represent Mayor Daley. For 20 years, I represented the mayor in the legislature, and he was always right. So that's deference. That's a deference to authority. And that was a good ethos in many ways. It was really tight communities, a lot of modesty, a lot of good character building. It had some weaknesses. Racism tolerated, sexism, anti-Semitism, emotional coldness, the food was really boring. Jonathan Sacks says it was a guest house culture. If you were part of the Protestant establishment, it was your home. If you weren't, you could stay in the home, but you had to really behave the way the host wanted you to behave. And so you were just a guest. And people decided, that's not good enough for us. And so they revolted and they shifted the culture. And they shifted to a different culture, which was a more individualistic culture. And the symptom of that culture to me, and I mentioned this here, was one of the high points of my childhood. In 1969 or 70, there was a Super Bowl between the Baltimore Colts and my team, the New York Jets. And I realize I'm on dangerous ground here. But that was a year when my team, the New York Mets, beat the Baltimore Orioles in the World Series. My team, the New York Knicks, beat the Baltimore Bullets in the NBA Finals, and my team, the New York Jets, beat the Baltimore Colts in the Super Bowl, so I'm just saying. But so there were two quarterbacks by the end of the game on that field, and they both grew up within miles of each other in Western Pennsylvania, but 10 years apart. And the older one was Johnny Unitas. And you all know Johnny Unitas, 1950s kind of guy. Crew cut, high top sneakers, played like a plumber. He was just a great player, but workmanlike, didn't brag, didn't show off, just was part of the team. On the other side was my hero, Broadway Joe Namath. Just grew up a few miles from Johnny. Wore $5,000 fur coats, posed for pantyhose, long hair, he was a swinger, said I'm anti-institutional. He wrote a memoir called I Can't Wait Until Tomorrow Because I Get Better Looking Every Day. Johnny Unitas would not have called his memoir that. And so that was a shift in culture. Suddenly it was no longer cool to be, it was better to be young, not old, expressive, not reticent, casual, not formal, a rebel, not a conformist, individual and not institutional. And basically in 1962, a bunch of kids got together in Port Huron, Michigan, and said that old culture stinks. We need a culture where we're free to be ourselves. And so from a culture that said we're all in this together, we went to a culture that said I'm free to be myself. And it was individualistic, autonomy, authenticity, a whole new set of values. And that new culture gave us the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, the peace movement, the Age of Aquarius. I don't think we could have had Silicon Valley and the rebel individualism of Silicon Valley without an individualistic culture. So it had some great qualities. And that's the thing about cultures. They're collective efforts to solve the problem of the moment. And there's a reason society adopts a culture, because it works for them at that moment. The problem is it gets a little old. And we've had about 40 years of individualism. We've had individualism of the right, which emphasizes economic individualism. We've had individualism of the left, which emphasizes lifestyle individualism. But it's been individualism all the way down. And it's created a few results. One of it is a rise of narcissism and a rise of belief in self. There's a test called the narcissism test, which they give people statements and they say, does this apply to you? And there are statements like, I find it easy to manipulate people because I'm so extraordinary. or I love to look at my body. Or somebody should write a biography about me. And the median narcissism score has gone up 30% in the last 20 years. Americans perform 25th in the world in math. If you ask people around the world, are you really good at math? We're number one in the world in thinking we're really good at math. And so we've become a culture that celebrate self. And that has had some downsides and three overlapping crises. The first is a crisis of isolation. If you asked Americans in 1980, are you lonely, 20% said yes. Now that number has doubled. 35% of people over 45 are chronically lonely. In 1970, married couples had people over to their homes as guests 15 times a year. Now, on average, it's 8 times a year. Only 8% of Americans report having important conversations with their neighbor. The fastest growing religious party is unaffiliated. The fastest growing political movement is unaffiliated. 9 million working age men have dropped out of the labor force. The suicide rate is now at a 30-year high, and suicide is just a proxy for loneliness. We now have twice as many people dying of suicide as die of car crashes, 45,000. We have 55,000 people dying of opiate addiction, and opiate addiction is just slow motion suicide. So there's the isolation problem. The second is the institutional crisis, an alienation problem. In that old world, we're in this together, if you ask people, do you trust your institutions? Back then, 45% or 80% of Americans said, yeah, my institutions are basically trustworthy. Now it's 22%. If you ask, do you trust the people around you? It used to be 60% said, yeah, the people around me are trustworthy. Now it's 32% and 19% of millennials. Each age group is more distrustful than the one before it. And they're more distrustful not out of perception, but out of reality. They're more distrustful because people are less trustworthy. And so there's just been a decline of alienation and a rise of social distrust. The third is a crisis of meaning. It's amazing to me that even given the fact that we know so much more about the brain, that mental health problems are on the rise, not falling. Depression rates are rising, not falling. And that is because, in part, partly it's isolation, partly a lot of people don't know the meaning of their lives, what the purpose of their life is. I've come to expect it from a lot of my students. They get out of college, they're doing great, they're amazing people, but then they have a setback. And they have a setback because of a romantic breakup or lose a job, and they crumble. And Nietzsche has a phrase, he who has a why to live for can endure anyhow. He who has a why to live for can endure anyhow. But if you don't know why you're in this, then when you have the setback, you just fall apart and you get a crisis. And I don't blame the young people for that. I blame those of us who've made them so ill-prepared to ask the question, what is the purpose and meaning of my life? Who've given them down no moral vocabulary to even think about that question. And it, you know, you take a look at the commencement addresses, which I look through, and they're all filled with garbage advice. We give young people a big mountain of debt and then give them garbage advice to make sure they'll never pay it off. Basically, we give them the ethos of our boomer era, which is freedom. What should they do in life? They're getting out of college, they want to know, what do I do with my life? What do I devote my life to? And we tell them, be free, be free. That's what they got, they're already free. They want to know, how do they make decisions, the big decisions about their life? And we say, don't worry, your future is unlimited. Take risks, the journey is the destination. That gives them nothing to hold on to, it's just an empty box. So then they ask us, well, where do I find wisdom? What's the source of authority I can go to that'll help me answer my questions? And we give them the empty box of narcissism. Look inside yourself, find your true inner voice, find your passion, you're amazing, you do you. The you is the one thing that hasn't formed in them yet. And so that's completely useless. And so then we give them a whole series of boxes, which is, you're on your own. Be your own guide, find your own truth. And so any handhold has been taken away by a culture of individualism that can't talk to them in any way that'll help them find their own moral guidance. And so what happens with these three crises of isolation, alienation, and meaning? If you leave people naked and alone, they do what their evolutionary roots tell them to do, which is they revert to tribe. And that is what's happened. We have a world of negative polarization, what the political scientists call negative polarization. Negative polarization, if I ask you, do you like your political party? You say, eh, it's okay, not so much. Do you hate the other political party? Totally. And it's politics driven more by hatred of the other side than love of your own. That's negative polarization. And tribalism is different from community. Community is based on affection and love, and when you love your own community, you really don't mind if somebody loves some other community. That's great. But tribalism is based on friend-enemy distinctions, us-them thinking, and building boundaries and erecting walls. It's a way to build solidarity by hatred, not love. And so it's always zero-sum. There's a scarcity mentality that there's not enough, and so groups are always struggling for each other over the spoils, build walls, erect barriers, think in conspiracies, think in apocalyptic terms. Dog eat dog.